Welcome, everybody. Welcome to our session today. My name is Cynthia Stevens, and I'm the Vice President of Demand Generation at Lionbridge. I'm really excited. We have a fantastic panel today. I think you're going to have a terrific conversation and dialogue about the future of the localization industry. We have four topics. We'll spend 15 minutes on each, but I first want to give you an introduction to each of our distinguished panelists today. We are joined today by Renato Beninato, from NIMSI Insights. We're joined by Dr. Ara Lomel from CSA Research, also joined by Kyatin Malinowski from Lionbridge and Brian Randall from Lionbridge. So I'll ask maybe each of you to just do a quick intro for yourselves before we kick things off today. And maybe Renato, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's exciting to be here. I'm Renato Beninato, the CEO of NIMSI Insights, a market research and consulting company in the language services space, and welcome.
Fantastic. Arl, would you like to go next?
All right. I'm Arl Lomel with CSA Research, where I'm a senior analyst working on technology and some of the futures. And some of you may notice that Don DePalma was billed to be here, but he just had his second COVID vaccination and wasn't up to participating today. So you get me instead.
Thank you. And Kyatin.
Hello, everyone. My name is Kyatin Malinowski. I'm with Lionbridge. My role is product director, and I'm looking forward to this webinar.
Fantastic. And then Brian.
Hi, everyone. Brian Randall here, Vice President of Strategic Accounts at Lionbridge. But prior to that, I was a client for 4 years, and I'm excited to bring both perspectives of our strategic accounts that we have at Lionbridge, as well as when I was in the field doing this myself. So thank you for having me.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, it's a great, great panelists, really good dialogue that I'm expecting today. And Jamie Punishel was also not able to make it today, but as you'll see, I think we're going to have a really nice, provocative conversation. So what we talked about was having four real themes that we're going to focus on, spending about 15 minutes on each. So the first of those themes is going to be about changes in the localization industry, spend a little bit of time on that. Then we want to talk about content and the content strategy and content journey, how that's changing, how you think about that holistically. We want to follow that with a discussion around tech, machine translation, TMS systems, and really have a conversation about language technology. And then we want to round it out on a conversation around ROI and pricing, and how do you measure the impact of all of this work. Please submit questions as we go along. I know every one of the panelists has agreed to kind of take those throughout the conversation. So I'll be monitoring those in the Q&A, and feel free to continue to submit those. And of course, we'll leave plenty of time at the end as well to get through those. So I thought we'd start by looking back before we can look forward to the future of the LOC industry, and really want to talk about for a minute, how did the industry fare last year? You know, obviously it was a very unusual year. How did things go? And maybe Renato, start with you to get us going on that.
Well, thank you. This in futurology is called the slingshot approach, right? You look back at what happened in the past, and you identify patterns, and you see how you're going to move forward. The interesting thing is that 2020 was the big crisis that wasn't. There was a lot of speculation at the beginning of the year when NIMSI published the NIMSI 100 back in February of last year, 1 year ago. We were very uncertain about how much the industry was going to grow, even though we knew that it was going to grow. One of the characteristics of the language services industry is that it's an industry that has never seen a crisis. We like to say that it's impervious to crisis. It grows no matter what, because we grow on different vectors. We don't grow only because of the volume that increases, but we grow by the number of languages that keeps growing. We grow by the different platforms and technologies that are used, and because our industry affects every single aspect of economic activity, we are beneficiaries of any situation. as I heard back in the 2008 crisis, our industry is one that when the economy is growing, we translate contracts. When the economy is bad, we translate lawsuits. So we are on both sides of the spectrum when it comes to this. So I would say that as a starting point, there was a lot of fear, but the industry adapted very well. And looking at preliminary numbers, we're going to be publishing our NIMSY 100 in the next few days. We look at a growth above the average, which has been around 6.5 to 7% a year in CAGR, in cumulative aggregate, compound aggregate growth rate, right? So I would say that it's been an auspicious year, and 2021 looks even better.
Anyone else want to take a look back before we go ahead, Arl?
Yeah, not exactly a contrary note, but when looking more broadly than just the top 100, we find lower growth rates than companies had predicted in 2019. They're still positive, and they're exceeding the economy as a whole, which is significant. Mm-hmm. But there was a significant portion that did see revenue decreases. But what we found really interesting in interviewing what we call the ranked 193 was that 70% reported either stable or increased profitability. So even some that saw decreased revenue actually were seeing record profits for the year. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was because they were refocusing on things, dropping offices, emphasizing technology, and making changes that arguably they should have made years ago. That the crisis mentality, the freak out that happened back in April and May, prompted them to make overdue changes. And so I think that's why we're seeing, in part, so much positive growth right now, is the industry as a whole was very responsive to the immediate crisis.
I couldn't agree more.
My travel budget went all to profit.
Well, I don't know about that, but I couldn't agree more with you, Arlen, because when we look across industry sectors, you know, there were disproportionate industry sectors that were impacted in travel and hospitality in particular, more so than others. But what you struck on is exactly what we experienced with our clients and with our localization teams that we work with across the world, that this was an inflection moment. No longer could you attack a market. Digital transformation has been spoken about for 20 years. This was an inflection moment in 2020. And those companies that were flat-footed and had not prioritized those go-to-market strategies that were virtual, digital, had to. And so when you think about localization and you think about the fact that we don't just localize for the sake of localization, it's really about market and about communication, about bridging those gaps. And it impacted so many different areas beyond digital marketing. It impacted client and employee engagement. And the other area, because right now, today, in fact, we're on day three of a very large 20,000 person virtual event for one of our clients, providing them over the phone interpretive services and remote simultaneous interpretation. It's like it stretched the limits even of some of all of us to really rethink. How do we support multilingual in a world that is truly, at this point, virtual?
Yeah, Brian, I think you're spot on. Like, you know, the whole digital transformation, right? It was happening before, but really the whole pandemic kind of accelerated it. And it was a big catalyst for growth in localization industry. Not only like content exploded, right? There was more languages. Just when you think about, you know, many of our customers moved most of their activities, customer experiences, but also equally the workforce experiences online, right? And that meant that they needed to localize more, they needed to create more content, and essentially they needed more localization services as such, right? So it's I think surprisingly, pandemics was a big kind of catalyst for growth for localization industry.
Also, another element, if we look at the industry from the supply side, a strong indicator of the strength of the industry was the number of mergers and acquisitions that happened during the year, and especially with the large mergers and acquisitions happening. So Lionbridge made a fantastic deal selling a chunk of its business for over $1 billion. So we are already talking about $1 billion deals that started a couple of years ago, 3 years ago with LanguageLine. It's RWS, SDL, Lionbridge selling a chunk to TELUS. So this puts us in a different category, and this is attracting the eyes of the market to a segment that was many of our followers and listeners here are still from the time that this was just a craft, and now it's really, really, really big business.
Where does it go from here, Renato? Do you think this year, what changes are you sort of looking ahead and seeing what's coming?
Well, I think that one caveat that I like to make is that unfortunately, well, it's not unfortunately, it's just a reality. We are not driving what's happening in the industry because we are essentially a transformation business. We're constantly working on content and activities and things that our clients create, problems that our clients have. So we are always in the forefront of the challenges that large companies have. We're solving their problems when it comes to multilingual and international access to information, but we are always working on stuff that other people have created. We're not creating a lot of stuff. So our outlook is always as good as the outlook of the technology or the leaders in the industries that we work in. So if you look, and Arl brought up the general economic trends, if you look at the economy as a whole, it's performing better. When we talk about business, right? Of course, let's not talk about social, health, how do you say, unemployment issues and so on. Of course, there are big challenges, there are big problems. But if we look at a macro level, the outlook is very positive. And we follow that outlook. We tend to be in the leading edge of what is going on in the world. Because any business that wants to succeed needs to go international fast, because if they don't go international by themselves, somebody's going to copy them. And there is always a language element involved in that. So the technology is advancing at incredible pace in all segments, and we make that technology multilingual. So I believe that the outlook is fantastic. And I think, Kaitan, you were talking about some of these technologies the other day, like GPT-3 and things like that. What do you think?
No, thanks for bringing that up. I think you know, GPT-3 and is a fabulous technology, right? It allows us to for natural language generation, and it's going to disrupt how the content is created, how the content is localized. So, you know, I think it's really great technology that's coming up, and it's going to, I guess, disrupt a little bit localization and many other industries. You know, as in a similar way, like we've seen with machine translation, right? Everybody was talking, you know, 10 years ago, oh, machine translation is coming up. It's going to kill the industry. But that didn't happen, right? The volumes exploded. We've seen much more different types of content coming up, videos, websites, mobile apps. Everything became more immediate. There was more kind of complex file formats that needed to be handled. And it just got more sophisticated, right? So I think that's going to happen as well. And just technology is going to be catalyst for growth, but in a completely different way than in the past. Right, so I think it's one of the most probably exciting times for the localization industry today and kind of next couple of years.
Brian, what are you seeing there from a technology standpoint in terms of the companies that you work with?
Well, I once had the great privilege of speaking with Esther Dyson, and she one time told me that Technology is not Darwinian. It doesn't eat one another. Mm. It coexists and it learns its place. And so when you think of things like MT and you think of other technologies that we're now seeing emerging on, you know, speech recognition and getting to cleaner, you know, VTT and SRTs, and, you know, because we all speak differently as human beings. And so at the end of the day, what we're really trying to do is have effective communication. And that leads us to localization. Mm-hmm. It's not localization for the sake of localization. And so I think what I find interesting in this moment, being, you know, so close and on the front line with many clients, is that if this was just happening externally with your customer experience and your customer journey, that'd be one thing. But we get thrown a double whammy because it's also happening with your WX, which is your workforce experience, because mm-hmm. now the borders of attracting talent are down. It can be anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, retaining that talent, engaging that talent, making sure that you have the best possible customer journeys. I think it's a interesting time that we're living in, because all of these challenges that kind of had been at bay, and we had all of these go arounds where you were go to physical conferences or physical events or investor mm-hmm. conferences and things like that, all of those barriers are now down. So with that, you have wonderful opportunity, as you were saying, Ronaldo, but then you also have, well, what is the proper tool for the proper job? And to mm-hmm. me, that's, you know, I love to garden. Nobody's ever walked into a hardware store looking for a tool that didn't know what their issue was or what their challenge was that they were trying to solve. I think it's mm-hmm. the same thing with technology. Mm-hmm. We're all looking for what is the best way to communicate effectively, faster, better, and at a lowest cost. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to chip in there and just say, you mentioned customer experience. And one thing we saw in 2020 is most enterprises had really broken customer experience.
Totally agreed.
And it revealed what was already there. And then they realized, if it's broken in English, what is it going to be in Spanish or Portuguese or whatever? And that's really elevated the role of localization, is they're realizing they can't just take this for granted. Mm-hmm.
Arl, didn't you also, I think you recently had some new research, which may have touched on some different, you know, technologies, if we kind of segue into that topic for a minute. What are you seeing in terms of different tools, different technologies?
Yeah, so we've already talked a bit about machine translation and its improvements, but it isn't something that's just replacing humans. It's changing their role. And then, like in any industry, when you have mm-hmm. automation and technology come in, it removes low-level, repetitive, low-value tasks and puts humans in a more controlling role. And we're seeing the emergence of what we call augmented translation. We've talked about it for a few years, but this year is where it's really starting to come together, where you have this human-centric view where the linguist becomes an operator of multiple technologies that serve up information just in time and focus on relevant content. So they can say, oh yeah, this is great, I'm going to fix this, or no, this was garbage, I'm going to fix it. And the technology's learning at the same time. Here's where the AI component comes in, so that it becomes better over time and elevates the role of the human. And we just released a report this morning that's free, and I'll put the link in the chat for anyone who's interested in that.
It's a very interesting point. We often talk about, And what you're describing is this inexorable march towards increased productivity. The macro reality, and I tend to look at things from a big picture point of view, the macro reality is that there is more content than humans can handle. There is more growth in content than the growth of supply of talent to handle that content. So automation, and as you described, this augmented translation, it's essentially an improvement in productivity. It's how do you generate more content with fewer clicks? I like to tell this story. When I was in the beginning of my career as a translator, I used to smoke a lot. And every time that I found a word that I didn't know and I had to look up in a dictionary, I would get up, get the dictionary, open to a certain page, light a cigarette, and essentially read the whole page of the dictionary to translate one word. If I had to do that today, and that was, I was a very bad translator because I smoked 4 packs of cigarettes a day. So that's a bad indicator. But the point is that that reality that is 35 years old, it's completely different today. You have, and you have had, what you're describing, what your research describes, I imagine, Arl, is that it's getting easier and easier and easier for translators to increase their productivity and naturally the quality of their work because they have everything in one place, right? You don't need to get up and check the dictionary. You don't need to go and look up 20 pages to find out a translation for a word anymore. It's much more dynamic. And this is the reality that we're going to live with. Scarcity of talent, scarcity of qualified resources to do a very good job. So, and this is a topic that has been discussed a lot in our industry over the years. Machine translation is not the foe. It's essentially an opportunity for the translator to develop their skills and become better at what they mean.
My only statement I've ever made that was turned into a widespread meme was only humans who translate like machines will be replaced by machine translation.
Exactly.
I love it. I look at it from a slightly different perspective, and that is I don't view any localization team within any organization on Earth right now as needing one type of speed, one type of quality, or one type of technology. I think all of these technologies and all of these wonderful translators coexist beautifully when you look at the source type, the quality of content. What is needed? Is it speed? What we need in today's market is the ability to fail and fail fast, learn and adapt. And you cannot do that trying to perfect to a point of quality that requires 8-9 weeks of release. That is not the agile world that we live in for you know, whether you're developing software or you're H&M and you're trying to get a shirt on the shelf, you know, for a seasonal opportunity to take advantage of a market. At the end of the day, speed does count. And so we're having conversations now about, and forgive me, Renato, because I don't know a better way of saying this, but what is good enough?
Yeah.
What is good enough quality to test that market, to get the message out there, to get a toehold to then perfect later, fail fast. And agile environments require that. And so why would we think as localization professionals that our industry would not follow the same model? So again, not Darwinian. Machine translation is wonderful. It's fantastic for certain types of content, for PIMs, for product informations and things like that, where you want to be able to get there fast and get a robust offer there. And then I also look at it in terms of escalation, you know, because from the customer journey experience, mm-hmm. bots have been a wonderful tool to help us, you know, really get to, I know we're talking about localization, but I also think of it interpretive services, because to get to resolution requires a coordination of all of these things, from the email to the chatbot to the chat to the live call. Because at the end of the day, you don't want them to abandon that shopping cart mm-hmm. and you don't want them to break that time on site in order to get resolution, whether it's a customer success issue where you want to resolve their issue and renew their faith in your product, or whether it's the first-time buyer who's on your site looking and shopping. Because the power is with the consumer. And I think when you see it from that perspective, it helps guide that technology conversation around localization so much better, because sometimes it's okay to be just good enough.
And one of the elements, and our research has shown it over and over and over, is that the concept that what we are really in the business of managing complexity, right? Complexity is very hard to automate, because by the time you finish automating it, it has become more complex. So you need to automate it again. So complexity is the key word. And this is where humans and project managers and organizations strive, is dealing with constantly changing requirements, constantly changing environments. And this is the value that we as an industry bring to the economy as a whole. We manage complexity in international environments with multiple languages, in multiple formats, in multiple. So if you think of communication, just let's take communication, which is essentially the business that we're in. How many parts of an organization are responsible for communication with their stakeholders, all stakeholders, shareholders, employees, clients, competitors, regulators, tax authorities, and so on? All these channels of communication between organizations require some level of language conversion, let's put it this way, right? And this is it's complex. So an organization like Lionbridge and many other large and small organizations tend to work with certain parts. So the legal department probably will work with a vendor that specializes in the legal communication, while the website will work with a marketing organization, while the customer support will work with a completely different organization. And some of us work with all these different segments inside the organization. That's complexity. The company cannot coordinate their communication by themselves. How do we expect to be perfect in translation, in localization? So this is the reason why I'm very optimistic about the future of the industry, because I've seen this complexity rise. And complexity, and Arlo, you're the scientific guy. Is it entropy that we tend to entropy? The more variables we have, the more complex it's going to get, and that's beautiful. That's what maintains our business growing.
Well, and a corollary is, as you have a task and it increases, what you're doing increases linearly, the cost of the information to achieve that and to manage it increases exponentially. And so without technology, you can't get there. It's like the idea, if you have a big weight and you say, how many people can lift it? Well, if they all have to put a hand around it, you can't do it because you need to have some way to coordinate that effort and focus it.
In that context, or Kaiji, maybe you how important is a translation management system given all of that complexity, or a TMS? Is that a must have?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, the localization industry started with, technical translations maybe 30 years ago with, big technological companies kind of trying to resolve the problem, right, and the complexity that Renato was just alluding to. So we started seeing these systems kind of coming up, right? And now I think, as we all agree, there is a big kind of paradigm shift on not only how we do business in localization, but how companies, people communicate with each other, right? Just think about, how many different digital channels we have, right? We have websites, mobile apps, Twitters, Snapchats, and every year we see more and more of those, right? And they support many different file formats, right? So I think, TMSs have their place, and they help us automate the work, back to what Renato was saying. But on the other hand, I think, there's a lot of pieces of technology like content management systems or digital asset management systems that have become, over last decade or two, increasingly multilingual, right? So they started supporting these generic kind of multilingual workflows. So I think the roles of TMS is it's going to change, and it's going to be maybe become more niche system for LSPs or companies that have multiple and very complex content journeys, maybe very technical ones that need to pull in many different systems. But I think in a kind of broader kind of general localization industry, it's just going to lose a little bit of that importance.
I would add to this, Kaitan, I agree with everything that you're saying, and the TMS is something that is important to us. in the market, right? It's a way that makes it easier for us to interact with the content that the client generates and passes to us. But at the end of the day, what the client is buying is solving a business problem that they have.
Exactly.
And how this is done changes over time. I think that the shift in the TMS space that is significant for us to look at is the fact that companies that invested 30 years ago on World Server and IDEM World Server are weaning out of it now, right? Some of them started doing it 10 years ago. Once you committed to a certain type of technology, you're committing to a 15 to 20 year journey with that technology. In the last several years, we have moved more to a cloud environment that allows this transition and these communications, and the way that software is developed is more integrated, and it makes it easier for you to scale, to change, to move to different solutions. And this is where a specialist player, an LSP, plays an important role, is that you can play with all these different technologies, you can play with all these different environments, you're not stuck to a single solution. And if the client wants to shift because they graduated, they went from, let's use some names here. They went from SmartLink, they graduated, they need to go to a bigger solution, an SDL solution, or a MemSource or something like that. How that is done is very different than how it was done with World Server, with that big installations, with support systems, and so on. So it actually, the TMS environment being so dynamic, and this is why it's attracting so much investment these days. I think that there's only MemoQ that is not owned by private equity. You have more opportunity to provide services because you have more platforms, you have more integrations, you have a lot of this ancillary services that are not only language related, which are more engineering related, that are ways for the LSP to create value for their clients.
I'm going to disagree a bit with you, Kayatin, though. I think that TMSs are actually becoming more important, but we have to think about what TMSs are evolving to. If we think of them as the World Server kind of thing, those are clearly headed out. Mm-hmm. But the whole augmented translation paradigm requires a TMS behind it to choreograph these data flows, because you're bringing in so many sources and something has to have that controlling function. And that's where we're seeing TMS evolving to, is becoming something that manages data flows and brings them together intelligently to facilitate translation. And a multilingual CMS isn't going to do that because it's interested in displaying content, but it will happily consume that. And so I think what we're seeing is a real shift to microservices architecture, so you can plug in best of breed systems, and the TMS in a sense becomes the operating system of an LSP and fades into the background.
That's right, 100%.
You don't have to throw 10 levers to operate it like you do with World Server. It's just always there and always working for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right, Arl. And it's just, I think the notion of TMS is changing and the main users of the TMS are changing, right? Some sophisticated companies will still use TMSs, but as you pointed out, right, they're more evolving to these kind of microservices architecture. And we actually see a lot of, kind of artificial intelligence being baked into allowing to route the content automatically to the best, translators, to the best workflows. So I think that's the future. But that's not the future for every single sort of customer or user of TMS today.
I agree with Arlen, and I would add one thing. No client ever in the last 5 years has sat across from me and said, "Oh, I really need to buy a TMS. Can you sell me a TMS?" and it drives me kind of crazy being the customer guy here on this call, because what I talk about is things like source of truth, middleware, taking assets and putting them somewhere that are more agile, that can actually integrate. So it's the same thing that you're saying. but I don't use those types of, I can geek out with the best of them. And I, you know, go way back to the AIM days with Lisa and localization and, you know, industry and all of that. But when I'm sitting across from someone, I'm talking about their business issue. I'm talking about what they're trying to achieve. And we, you know, Lionbridge is not a secret. We don't sell TMS because we believe it's the cost of doing business. And we look at it as that's what we do for you every day. And we can work with SDL, Tridian, we can work with anybody. And we do. We have some of our largest clients on our competitors' sites. It doesn't matter to us. We try to stay focused on what are you trying to do? How are you getting there? And then we will bring expertise to bear to try to help that. Now, one of the interesting things, I'll give you a curveball here for a second, that we've been coming up against a lot lately, is that you have specialty folks within global companies around the world. And when you start thinking about the review tools that they use, that's where it gets cool, because you don't want to waste any employee's time when they are giving you their hard-earned insight and language capabilities internally at a company. And I wish that the industry would flip it and think of it from the customer point of view, because it's actually at the review step. And it's actually, I've already told you this once, why are you guys not using the segment that I've already done for you? That's what matters, not TMS. TMS is wonderful because it's a savings, but it's the outcome of it that should be the focus, in my opinion. But I'll be quiet now.
And that gets to a long-term problem in the industry, that when, you know, industry insiders go and pitch their things, they talk about cost per word and other things. It really needs to be elevating it to here's an investment and here's what you get from it. And we're speaking about the industry as a whole. It's notoriously bad at actually doing that.
Could not agree more.
You know, I think a few of you touched on actually coming around, flipping it to that customer viewpoint, but in amongst some of your comments is the content. And I think Kayatin, you even referred to the content journey there, right? Maybe we flipped to that. I know that was one of our topics and it's really related and it's come up in what you've been talking about. What are we seeing right now from the customer viewpoint in terms of this proliferation of content and how that may or may not be changing their strategy, right? And how they think about this entire process. Kayatin, I know you've thought about that a little bit. What are you seeing, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, you know, we see that customers, and especially now in the kind of COVID area, accelerated digital transformation times, you know, companies are struggling to deliver great and engaging content at velocity, right? So everybody's trying to figure out, okay, how do I do this at scale? How do I do this better in a more efficient way, right? And there is a number of different things that they are looking for. Sometimes it's technology, sometimes it's process changes. So we noticed that some of the most successful companies, they actually try to bring marketing and localization more closely together, because they are essentially, you know, two parts of one content journey, right? The marketing folks, they work closely with sales folks to understand, you know, what's the top line number that we have to hit. They kind of trying to translate it into some kind of content strategy, which means, okay, we have to create this many kind of articles or blog posts or web pages or whatever that content may be, in order to kind of help sales convert that into sales numbers. So you know, so that kind of goes then into content creation. That sort of is trying to follow certain guidelines, right? And then it goes to localization, right? And in the past, these two functions were sort of disconnected, disjointed, and it resulted in a kind of less than optimal journey, right? Somebody would create the content. It would maybe be just okay, not a perfect piece of content. It would go into localization. And somebody on this webinar was already saying this, right? Imagine what happens if the bad content goes into many, many languages, right? You have to fix it many times. There is a back and forth with local subsidiaries. There is additional cost of fixing it. No, not mentioning delays, which can impact, you know, product launches. And we've seen all of that, right? So in this reality today, we see that companies start thinking in terms of the holistic content journey, and they kind of bring together their localization and marketing departments so that they can figure out, okay, how we do this better. And they also kind of try to employ, some of the latest advances in AI to kind of track quality of the content, and then use these insights to improve the content creation process, right? So it really becomes this kind of cycle that repeats on and on and on, and with every iteration gets kind of better, faster, cheaper, more on point, on quality, right? So that's really the dynamic that we see with these days.
Kaitan, this is a very interesting point that you bring up, because we work a lot with the client side. Most of our engagements are on a mix. We start usually with technology, which is a symptom. The actual problem is something different, and it has to do with the content journey that clients have. And what is very interesting to find is it's an approach that we use here at NIMSY. I've been using this for, 20 years. It's like in crime novels, you have the classic rule, chercher la femme. And in content, the way I like to put it is follow the content and follow the money. Because what is traditionally the biggest barrier to achieve that nirvana of good policy, good strategy in terms of content, is the different budget owners. You are talking to, and different companies have different strategies. Some of them have centralized strategies. It's a single budget. Marketing and support have the same control and coordination, and it's totally fine. And in other companies, it's a digital policy a nightmare. So you will have the Chinese in-country manager telling the localization manager in Silicon Valley, hey, I'm never going to pay X cents per word if I can buy Chinese translations here in China for 3 cents, 4 cents per word. Why are you charging me 25 cents for that word? And then you start having this money conversations. And this is where, Arl, you brought up the cents per word, the per word conversation in the industry. What we see, and we go back to the complexity element, is that it's all nice and dandy from a philosophical and rational point of view, but at the end of the day, you have internal budgets that compete for attention, and people need to make choices. And if you go into an organization like Oracle that is buying, 5-6 companies a week, or Apple, 4 companies a month, and so on, until they integrate into that culture, you're going to have products. I remember looking at Cisco, this is a very old story, but they had 100 different words for the same equipment that they had. One router was referred to in 100 different ways in English. Multiply that by as many languages. And then you would have products that would be localized into 5 languages, and other products that would be localized into 100 languages. So this is where that conversation that we were having before about complexity comes in. It makes sense for us to talk theoretically about a perfect content journey, but even very mature clients will have a hard time making that happen. There is a conversation, and we have those conversations with the clients. It's a wishful thinking. And in a way, I think we live in a reality where you can count on your fingers the companies that have really mastered that ideal scenario that you describe. Prove me wrong. That's my challenge.
No, I agree. I think you're right. But more and more companies are kind of becoming aware of this, and they're trying to solve this. They realize this is a problem, and they try to align, right? And I don't know if there is a silver bullet that works for everyone. I think, there are different content journeys, there are different industries, right? It's a different story in legal, life sciences, and many kind of general other industries, right? So yeah, I think generally these two functions will get closer. And as you pointed out, right, they are also looking at their budgets and how they spend money. And I think they're also kind of trying to understand, you know, their technology spends, right? Because the line between, you know, localization, marketing, technology kind of starts blurring, right? Between all of these SEO, you know, systems that help you optimize your content, CMSs, TMSs, machine translations, some sort of different men in the middle type of software, right? All of this kind of starts blending into one. And sometimes, you know, they just realize like, okay, we are spending too much. We could just downsize, right, and spend more on creating and curating the content than just on technology.
I don't prescribe to a one-size-fits-all for content. So it's hard for me to comment on this because I see it and breathe it every day. And I agree with you, Kayatin, from a digital marketing perspective and for a digital source of truth. When I say source of truth, I mean, you know, how are you defining that one term in auto instead of having 100? Because there has to be a source of truth within an organization. But that is not the same for legal, compliance, e-learning, HR. And so everybody's solving different things. And now I would also challenge you that I've also seen the flip side of that, where you have centralized versus decentralized. And I've walked into organizations that have had very strong centralized localization and couldn't get an email out the door for 3.5 weeks. You cannot survive in today's economy if you cannot get an email in market in Sweden next Thursday to coincide with the discount that you're providing to the customer. So the digital marketing teams were pulling their hair out because the systems had grown so complex that they could literally not get out of their own way to market. So I've seen it both ways. And I don't think that there's a one size fits all with it. I think that you have to go back to the point of what is the objective of the content and build a workflow that's agile and nimble to achieve that objective. Because at the end of the day, that's really what's going to drive it, you know.
Arl, I think you've recently done some research looking at kind of removing waste and content audits. What are your thoughts? What are you seeing?
Yeah, there's a lot that can be done here with all the systems that have to work together and the silos there. But often that's just the tip of the iceberg, because the technical things, yeah, nobody seems to solve them, but at least they're in principle solvable. But then you get, you know, the example of Oracle is a good one. How do you now integrate the cultures and get everybody pulling on the same oar rather than doing their different things? And that's, we have to think of interoperability more broadly in those terms, so that we're thinking about what are all the sources that cause this waste? And the technology is often a symptom of broader organizational dysfunction. And then thinking of the content audit bit, so many companies think content audits is merely listing what they produce, when it should be really going in ethnographically working on this and saying, is this meeting needs? What is the function of this? Can we reduce this? Can we simplify it so that we can get it out faster and make it simpler to deploy? And where you have assets, looking at some of the intelligent content technologies that allow to have content that's reconfigurable and customizable without having to phone home and get an edict from the Pope to say, yes, let's make this into a checklist rather than a set of instructions or whatever. So there's a lot that can be done here.
And it's interesting, when we talk about content audit, one of the conversations that I frequently have with both LSPs and mostly clients is that the biggest challenge, we talk a lot about translation memory, but we don't talk about, and you called it waste, I say that the things that we need to forget, right? There are lots of stuff that we need to unlearn. There's lots of stuff that we need to forget, because change is happening, and change, we don't realize that a lot of the rules that we created in a previous environment don't apply anymore. I mean, how much weight are companies carrying with old translation memories? I've worked with a client where essentially the recommendation to the client is throw away all this translation memory that you have. It's a waste. It's carrying, it's weighing on your productivity, it's weighing on your quality. Just start from scratch. get your latest version of whatever product you have, build a new translation memory and take it from there. There are many ways. There are ways that we need to think, because we tend to look at our business as insiders and we put a lot of weight on the things that are important to us. And we keep going back to the concept of the client. And the client at the end of the day is not the client who is buying translation from us, is the client of the client, is the consumer of the information, is the consumer of the translation. It's that guy who is on the other side of the world and consuming that content and asking. They don't care if there is 100% consistency. Can they get their product to work the way they want? Then can they get the information that they need? Can they be can they get from one place to another the way that they want, right? So we're frequently talking about our own priorities and our own problems, when the reality is, and this is a lot of the work, and Arl, I'm sure that you guys at CSA do the same thing. A lot of the work that we have working with the client is really in a content audit is teaching the client to forget, to let go, to abandon. It's almost a therapy, right? Hey, you know, it's not that important. You can let go.
Doesn't matter you did it this way for the past 10 years. You're wrong.
Exactly. But it's a fascinating exercise to think about the things that it's also counterintuitive, is making it lighter, taking it away. And sometimes there is a change that requires that. I would say that more than 50% of the engagements that we have today start with a TMS problem. Oh, we need to change our TMS. And then when you start really looking at the root causes and what you need to work on, you end up finding that what the client thinks is critical, is a problem, is not really a problem. And you end up saving money by optimizing the way you do work. We've worked with a company in 2020 that had been doing things the same way for 30 years. That problem that you mentioned, Brian, getting an email out, very hard.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, and I also think that we don't do a good job sometimes as an industry with really framing the question appropriately. And I spend a lot of time trying to think from the standpoint of the customer and what they're trying to do. And a case in point on that is around source quality, because a lot of times with an audit or an LQS, it's done at the tail end. Well, if I wrote that article, okay, take a piece of content. I write a piece of content. It goes through the whole process. It gets published. And then you take it and you look at it from an LQS standpoint. How many weeks have passed by? Five, six? How are you going to impact actually helping someone create better content if you're not doing that on the front end? So we actually have a predictive analytic that we do, that we've been doing it for 2 years, but we never offered it to our clients, where we can talk about readability at the time of source creation. Because that's when you want to know. You don't want it to go through localization if it's not leveraging TM savings the way that you think it should, or if it has offensive terminology in it and it needs to be more inclusive, or if it's not at the right readability level. And so this is not rocket science, but it's moving it to the right phase of when the content can actually impact the engagement so that you're not doing it backwards.
I love what you're saying. And this is one of the things, one of the advantages of being old and being in the industry for a long time, is that you see the patterns and how things repeat themselves, right? So AcroLinks came up with that solution 20 years ago, right? Hey, we have, you write your content in our tool and you press a button and there is a localizability ratio. There will be a number that says, okay, if go back and write it again, because if you translate this into German, it's going to completely fail. Everybody turned that off. Nobody wanted to do that, because were talking about failing fast before. But if people who are writing content, they need to match their deadline, they need to do their things, and they don't care, right?
Understood.
It's beautiful to talk about it. It's romantic, but
It's not beautiful to talk about. It's about framing and giving guardrails to a conversation so that you can actually have a dispassionate in a creative space conversation about readability, around inclusion, and actually correcting it. And you're absolutely right. Acrolinks, now Grammarly, there's a lot of tools that are out there that can be put on the source creation. But that's not really where the problem is. The problem is sitting there with the translation team when they've got this content and or the product marketing team that's trying to get it to market and actually have it engage and have those calls to action actually do something on the top half of the funnel. And that's where those conversations derail, because there's no KPI that they're consistently looking at. So if you flip the conversation and you put it to where it needs to be at the product level or the localization level, now you can frame the conversation to change the behavior. If you just put the tool on the CMS, then you're right. The person can just ignore it. I ignore Grammarly all the time when I'm typing.
and you know what's fascinating about this?
If you need a stick, though, talk to your accessibility groups.
100%.
Because they often have a lot of power to make things happen. And if you can tie this to accessibility, you'll have a lot of oomph behind you.
Literally, before getting on this webcast today, I was literally on a client call, and I said that what my papa has always taught me, carrot, stick, which one do you want to use? You want to use carrot, because that actually drives behavior. And so when you start thinking about cost savings, you start thinking about engagement, people hitting their own personal targets because the market is responding to their content, that's how you get them to change. You can beat them over the head with a stick, but you're only going to get to beat them over the head with a stick a few times. They're going to walk out the door. They're going to do something else. Because at the end of the day, there's very few of those types of regulations, Arlie, that actually will be the stick that you need. Now, readability is one of those things in medical care and health, in life sciences, you know, being at a certain readability. Absolutely should be a game changer. The content comes through. It doesn't match. Kick it back. Rewrite it, right? That's an easy one. Where this gets challenging is when you're trying to engage content and you're trying to drive market and you're trying to drive, you know, the consumer. So I completely agree with you. I just try to think of it as, how can we give them a big old carrot, you know, as opposed to the big stick?
Well, you know, what I've noticed over the decades is that, and I mentioned this before, that we are a transformation industry. We work on stuff that other people create. So and we have a hard time influencing the creation, because it's the famous throwing over the wall and etc. But where it makes a difference, and Brian, you brought the point of KPIs, is how is success defined inside the organizations? And the ones that are most successful in terms of localization are the ones where it comes from the top.
100%.
If comes from the leader, look at a company like Canva that is in, I don't know, 150 languages, growing exponentially. The founder of the company tells that global growth, is part of their strategy. So everybody thinks global. Mm-hmm. If you go to a company like Netflix, who overnight, without having a real strategy, says, hey, we're going to be tomorrow in 120 countries. Guess what? Their localization huddles, organizes, and it becomes a priority, because that's the way that they see growth. I think that the first company, and going back, Cynthia, in the beginning you talked, let's look back, let's look at the slingshot approach. I think that the first companies that really did this from a strategic point of view were IBM and Sun Microsystems. Sun Microsystems had five drivers, and going global was one of them. Mm-hmm. So everybody in the organization thought that way. But the reality is that the majority of the companies still, localization is an afterthought. If you look at their, you go to their financials, and you're going to see that many large public companies in the United States get more than 50% of their revenue from outside the United States.
Agreed.
But they still get 50% from here. Right?
And guess what? It's more as an afterthought. It's more expensive. Yeah. It gets conclusively proved every year with Taos and with, I mean, every survey about can't read, don't buy. I mean, if you think of like give you a real example for a second, because sometimes when on these webcasts, I want to give people some pearls that they can go back and actually dig into. A software manufacturer, this is the classic mistake. Their Scrum teams are checking in and out every day on what? GitHub, more than likely it's GitHub mm-hmm. or a similar process. If you wait until all of that code is fully baked and then you try to localize it, are you going to hit your deadlines to actually get it out the door in 15 languages? No. You need to have agile, continuous translation happening, check in, check out. So it's grabbing net new every time. So that all of a sudden you get down, you're like, product team, we're good to go. Great. We're going to be out the door and in market in less than 14 days. Mm-hmm. You can't do that. And then some people who have maybe an older mindset say, well, yeah, Brian, but you might be duplicating efforts or whatever. What, 5%? Yeah. Is that not worth being in market? For 5%, that's my point. Exactly.
It's a cheap waste, right? It's
exactly.
cheap waste.
Exactly.
It's a sunk cost. Those are the words that we need to talk about.
Doesn't meet their goals. I want to segue, because we've touched on it, into the last topic here in the last few minutes, which was the ROI. So if assuming from the top they do have this strategy for growth and localization, how do they measure the return on that investment? And I know, you know, Arl, you've looked at that, you know, in the panel, but how do they start to think about the return on the investment? Is it growth in those markets? Kaiten, I know you've looked at that as well, but Arl, maybe what are your thoughts? Start with you.
Yeah, so I think one of the key things that really is the framing of it as investment, because if we start talking about it as a cost, the battle's already lost.
Right.
But if you can come in and you can speak to the executive team about things like total addressable market and how much of the total addressable market is not addressable in a country because they don't offer the language, then you've got something. And they may even say, well, okay, we're going to Germany. They all speak English. But the research shows the Germans don't want to deal with English. And because they have German content from competitors, they don't have to put up with it. And so we can actually calculate, you know, what the drop-off is and what the uplift is by adding languages. And I think that's where the discussion needs to get, is saying, okay, well, taking it the other way, at the height of the crisis, we had companies that would come to us and say, let's drop some of our low-performing languages. And we could say, well, you can do that, but that's a self-inflicted wound that's going to be bleeding for a long time after this is over. Because you've turned, maybe you were predicting a 25% decrease for the year because of COVID. Well, you're going to add 6-7% to it. That, you know, you're measuring that in millions or billions of dollars for an investment of a few hundred thousand. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the conversation needs to go, is what is the consequence if we do this? And back it up with numbers about that are real about your TAM in a market, mm-hmm. your service addressable market, and then what we like to now call the PAM, the putative addressable market, which is if you actually had your language, what could you get?
Mm-hmm. Right. Kaiten, I know you've looked at this a little bit with CSA as well. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's exciting time because, you know, for many, many years in localization, we've been struggling with this notion that it's kind of, you know, sunken cost. Like, you invest, you have to have it, but you kind of cannot really track the results. I think lately with, you know, all the great research from CSA, but also with all the advancements in digital marketing and all of these technologies that allow us to calculate and really put things in perspective on, you know, how much money you invest versus how much traffic you generate, how many customers you convert, right? I think these numbers are much more readily available. And there is many different, you know, groups, companies that are kind of playing with this, testing out different models and really understanding the phenomenon of ROI on content, ROI on localization. And with the number, the kind of TAMs and other things, you can really put things in perspective and really demonstrate, like, and make the conscious decisions, right? Not only go to market decisions, but also, like, where do I divest? Like, how do I free up some of my budget without impacting least the revenue, right? So these are all, I think, interesting dynamics that we see happening and discussions that haven't just been possible a couple of years ago. And I think that's really, really exciting.
Yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with ROI. Because the moment you start, it's usually the question that is raised by an adversary, by a person that doesn't want to do it. And it's always an uphill battle because they're always going to find something to counter that. For us, naturally, the ROI is obvious. And as Arl said, it's the person who's asking for an ROI is looking at it from a cost perspective and not from a benefit. What I have seen is that companies that define their strategy based on customer satisfaction, based on penetration, based on other analysis than ROI, they will look at the cost. But my main data point is that you very, very, very seldom see a company pull out a language. Once they start doing a language pair, they're going to continue doing it forever. Occasionally, and I think that I can count just a few case studies that I've had where the ROI was negative and people pull out. Generally, and a big question, and you brought that, Brian, in the case of support is usually a big question. How am I going to provide support to a product in a market where I don't have in-country staff, where I cannot provide support locally? But today with interpretation and bots and chats and things, exactly, those things have become not real barriers, quite the opposite. It's a proof of concept. You go into the market with over the phone interpretation for telephone support, if you still have telephone support. And if there is a lot of demand, I can make the case to build a solution for that. If there is no demand, you'll provide with what you have. So the conversation about ROI is always a tricky one. And you can find multiple ways to present and calculate, and the real skeptics will not want to do it.
The only thing I would add, is the game changer here was 18 years ago, Google Analytics, plain and simple, and then Omniture, and then Adobe Analytics. So the thing that I always go back to with every single one of my clients, and if you're on here, you know I do this all the time and it drives them crazy, is I ask them the question, well, what are you tracking right now? What's in the analytic that you're tracking? Because that's how I turned to my CEO when I was a client and got Chinese and Spanish added to my websites, because I track the abandonment rate. These are not unknown quantities. It is a very easy process with any basic analytic tool out there to be able to track these markets by language and understand, oh, they're looking at an English site and they're abandoning it 3 times the rate. Wow, let's put something in Chinese in front of them and see if they react. That's really what it comes back to. I know it sounds basic, but I think sometimes we get so ahead of ourselves way up here. And sometimes it's really just about keeping score. Nobody's ever won a ball game not keeping a score. And you got to know. So if somebody wants to throw ROI at you, great. What are you tracking?
It's a great point, Brian. I'm going to pause the discussion for a minute just because there's a question that's come in. So I want to make sure that we can address that. And it goes back, I think, to what we were talking about. Renato, you were talking about kind of globalization being set as a strategy from the top. And the question is really, how can we as leaders impact the mindset of companies that are first considering globalization strategies that take them beyond just offering US English everywhere? Thoughts on that? It's really about folks that are really first starting to consider it. Or can we?
We can.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Brian, why don't you jump in?
I mean, the very first thing that so if I understand the question correctly, Cynthia, what you're saying is for somebody who is a global monolingual company right now, and they're looking at first steps, right? Am I correct?
Is that yeah. So the full subtext is, hey, you know, it's hard to convince a company about the merits of globalization, right? Mm-hmm. But how can we impact their mindset if they're beginning to consider globalization strategies? Is there anything that we as salespeople, yes, as leaders in the industry can do to kind of help those that are beginning to think about that as an offering, as a strategy?
I mean, I think Can't Read, Won't Buy is one of the most important tools out there. I think having data and intelligence around all of the different tools, everything that we've really talked about, but I always go back to the money, right? I go look at where are you selling your solutions and services? And outside of non-English speaking countries, and that also drives me crazy because being an American who speaks Spanish, 53 million Americans speak Spanish. And for those companies and brands who understand that they want to appeal from a sentimental level to the Latina head of household in the United States, then speak to her in that language. And that's, it kind of is a pet peeve of mine with American companies. And that's something that I always try to talk to. But it starts with data, guys. It always starts with data. And it starts with who is your consumer? Who are you actually selling to? What Renato said a moment ago, it's not about who they're selling to, but it's who is the consumer on the other end of that. Mm-hmm. And just know that at the end of the day, all of that is trackable and you can begin to build a case. Don't boil the ocean. Don't start with 18 languages, you know, learn and grow. Pick one market and learn and grow. I feel the same way about SEO, SEM, PPC. You can't go out there and you go out there and pick 15 languages, you're gonna make 15 mistakes.
You'll
pick
fail.
One, do it right, and replicate.
And replicate.
Fail fast and replicate.
That Spanish one is a great example because if you take US Spanish and break it out, it's the 10th most economically significant language in the world. It's ahead of Italian.
Exactly.
And it's ignored by so many companies that actually provide Spanish, which is a smaller opportunity.
Totally.
Yeah, that also depends on the segment that you are. It's very different in certain segments. But the comment, and I wanted some time to think about it, and I think that the right way to frame this answer is to see, if you want to make this relevant for the buyer, you need to see what is important for the buyer.
Exactly.
So if it is revenue growth, you're going to talk about revenue growth. If it is market share, you're going to talk about market share. If it is stock price, you're going to talk about stock price. What is the metric that is important for this company that is trying to go global for the first time? So that's one element. The other element, and Can't Read, Won't Buy, I started that research 20 years ago. Now in my company, it's called Project Underwear, available for free in all your best websites. Project Underwear reinforces this concept that people like to buy in their own language. It's human nature. I am a native Portuguese speaker. I can't help it. I always check the Portuguese, even if it is just to check how a word was translated. I'm sure Caetan does the same thing with Polish. I can do the whole journey in English, but I always go back and check how are they addressing my people? How are they addressing my language? And so on. So there is this cultural element that is very strong. And it's the same thing with the Latinos, with the Chinese, with the Russians. And here in the United States, which are big, or even Hmong, Aramaic, all the different languages that are... Yeah. Minority languages in the United States are huge opportunities. You don't even need to go international to have this. If you look at a healthcare company in the United States, if they're not doing at least 15 languages, they're not reaching the market because these are US citizens that have a second language in their household.
100%.
Yeah. I just wanted to make a quick comment here. I completely agree with all of you. I think it also speaks to that customer experience that the end user gets, right? And back to Renato's point, language is very personal, right? And every one of us who went to abroad and learned a couple of words, right, in the local language and went to a store and tried to speak it, right, you could immediately see that it was completely different discussion, right? It was more personal, more direct, right, more kind of human to human. And I think that really speaks to the force, like, why do you need to make your products available into different languages, right? The human aspect to it. And yes, we all can speak, or most of people can speak different languages locally, regionally relevant, like, you know, English or Chinese or many, many others. But if you speak that language of the other part, it really makes a difference. And it's so much easier conversation.
That's a great...
I'm going to throw a monkey wrench out here just for a second. Okay. And that is, I think for too long that there's been a gender bias in marketing. There's been a gender bias in senior leadership across the globe. This is not new. This is not, I'm not throwing out some sort of big, you know, concept. Empathy matters. And if you can't empathize with your customer and you don't have people at every level of your organization from a diversity standpoint, from a gender standpoint, who can actually be that voice and who can actually think from that perspective, because guess what? Your comment about healthcare, Renato, is absolutely critical, because if your child is sick, you want to be reading it in your language. It doesn't matter that you can speak English. And we just saw an uptick in open enrollment of 25% for one of our clients who actually took that journey into Spanish. But dental uptick, 40%. So it's like, at the end of the day, if you really think of your customer journey and you empathize with the customer and you create from that standpoint, you're not going to be in an ROI discussion with your CEO, because at the end of the day, the market will respond and you will be close to the customer and revenue will be there. It is just a fact.
The biggest data point, it's important that you bring up the point of healthcare and decisions and so on, because all the research, the consumer research tells is that things that are really, really, really important, contracts, lease agreements, prescriptions, things that really have lots of words that are important to you, if you put that in the local language, it increases. There is a fantastic case study about a Swedish company, a real estate company, that translated their leases into Arabic and the languages that are minority languages in the market. And they saw benefits because the cost of maintenance went down, because people read in their lease and they understood how to take the trash out, how to do the laundry, how to use the facilities in a way. And the savings was not in the contract. You could measure that, but you measured in the behavior of the people who are reading those instructions. It's amazing the miracles that language does, even without leaving your own country.
I want to take another question that came in through LinkedIn, and the question is back to also something we were talking about earlier. She says, I want to hear what others think about translating without a source, aka copywriting to a brief. Because she's saying it's going back to, I think, what you said earlier about the shortage of talent. Thoughts on that?
I just will throw it out there that if you're in a consumer model and you're trying to appeal to different regions, taking an English source and trying to, I'll give you a real example. I try to give like the crazy example, but I want to give you a real one. So recently in the fourth quarter of last year, there was one of our retailers was using a dad joke, right? Everybody know what I mean by a dad joke, right? You know, dad humor. Doesn't translate. You can't take a joke and translate it and make it actually funny. So think of that with your content from an SEO, SEM, PPC perspective. If you take the time to do treatments, whether they be blog posts or whatever, and you write them originally in language, they're going to be unique. What is Google going to do, or Adobe? It's going to rank it higher. You know, at the end of the day, if you're trying to solve attraction top funnel issues, and Cynthia, this is actually your expertise with digital marketing. And if you do it in language with thought leadership, and you never translate it to the other languages, if you can afford to do this, and if that market is important, I would argue you can afford to do that. You can't afford not to do it, because at the end of the day, you're trying to drive engagement, and unique content drives engagement. Taking an English source and simply translating it, yes, it works for product information, it works for a lot of different things, but it's not going to make you unique.
Yes, one word that is used around is transcreation, but the point here, it's a trend, but this has been around forever. And the approach we used to call this GRL approach, right? The global, regional, and local content. The more local it gets, the better it is to have it written in local language rather than translated. And the transcreation is just a description of that, which is essentially you take the brief and get the local. The best example of transcreation that I like is the old MasterCard, which aligns with your dad joke example, Brian, which is essentially very local experiences that are unique for people and two local experiences, and then the final being it's priceless, right? So this is something, it's good practice, actually, to the person who asked the question, having content written, but this is not something that you do for everything. It's for very specific types of content.
I think for some things, though, it actually doesn't go far enough. If you look at Adobe's experience, they work on promoting local in-market people who aren't employees to create compelling content, and then they promote it. And some of that actually they brought back into English. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't even a brief because no one in Adobe headquarters would have ever even thought of what was being produced. And so there's a lot of room now to enable your corporate content strategy to not be just a center out model, mm-hmm. but even to be a periphery in model and then a periphery in and back out model. And we're just beginning to explore this industry-wide.
I think that's exactly right. And I think something that we look at a lot, and from my perspective in marketing as well, right? You know, there's nuances and things that maybe at times it's better to be written in language from the region by somebody that has a knowledge of some of the cultural nuance. And instead of taking everything in English and just trying to translate it, localize it, transcreate it. And we're getting a little bit of chat, through this here, referring to local cultural trends and knowledge base and kind of, the importance of that, right? People chiming in here through LinkedIn and chat for us.
Well, the classic case is sports related. Different mm-hmm. countries have different sports, different calendars, right? One of the things that it's interesting is that Valentine's Day in Brazil is actually in June. There is the issue of seasons for the fashion industry. It's summer here, it's winter in the southern hemisphere. So your communication in Australia, New Zealand, Argentina is going to be very different from what you have here in the United States. So this type of hyper-local demand for content needs to be reflected in the strategy. But this seldom comes to the localization level. It stays in the marketing realm mm-hmm. very frequently. And like Arlo said, it's beautiful when you hear the local story coming up to the headquarters and becoming global from there.
I think Adobe's exceptional in that.
Exceptional. I completely agree. And the thing that companies don't always do is they look at social media and they think inward out instead of outward in. Yeah. Go listen to the markets. Don't talk, listen, because it's so easy on any one of Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook. You can have wonderful in-product intelligence happening if you just enable it. And you don't do that with human translators. You do that with MT, and then you escalate it to a higher value once you've identified those gems, those pearls. And Adobe does it better than just about anyone. I agree with
you. You're touching on a question that came in actually via Facebook, Brian, which is the question, do big companies have translation machines that can do the job of a translator? And then it needs no finishing touches without a human, it sounds like without human interaction, if I'm interpreting the question correctly.
Holy grail. So, I mean, everybody on this call could answer this, but what I would say is not to dismiss it at all. It's at a distance. And, we as human beings, we evolve. You got millennials in your life. Do you have teenagers in your life? My goodness. I can't even keep up with how they text and talk about, different acronyms and things like that. And for certain brands, that absolutely matters because you want to be cutting edge. You want to be associated with something that's hip. Well, what's hip? What's hip in Brazil is not going to be hip in Mexico City. What's hip in Mexico City is not going to be hip in Colombia, right? At the end of the day, this localization kind of thing is a bit of a challenge. But if you think that you can just set it and forget it, content is not all content. So you have to think about the right tool for the right piece of content. Exactly. If it's in mass, yeah, there's some really great MT engines out there that can get you to actionable data. To me, that's the key here. Because I don't have to understand everything. I just need to be able to get to an action, right?
And what makes sense.
It's, exactly. Yeah, it's what we use on social media. I mean, I read Facebook posts in Japanese or Norwegian, and I can't speak a word of those languages, right? But you get a gist. It's not perfect, but it serves the purpose. It's good enough, as you were saying.
Yeah.
And there is also the dynamic of time, right? These things change over time. Your example about the teenagers and the dad jokes made me think of one that I heard this week. Is that, remember, you know that radio station that used to play really old music? They're playing really nice music now.
I know you've thought about this a lot. Were you going to jump in there?
I just wanted, like, nothing really new to add here, but really my answer would be, you know, it depends on the content and on the context, right? What you're trying to accomplish. As long as it's good enough for, like, the use case that Renato just presented, I think it's fine. But for some more specific kind of use cases, it might be just too simple, right? And you need just higher quality level. What to me is really interesting is how machine translation evolves and improves so that it can cover more different types of content or these situations, right? And it gets better at all those old cases. So, and I think that's going to progress, but it will never replace, I think, translators. They will just get more specialized translators in specific domains, or they will work on other ways to augment content, make it more original, make it more personal, and so on and so forth, right? So I think the translation profession is going to evolve in just completely different way.
Well, you're touching on, I think, we've got a couple of minutes left, and it's been a really fascinating discussion. I was going to say, let's go down the line with everybody, kind of one last comment about the future of this localization industry. Kayatin, you started to touch on that, so maybe we'll start with you. Any parting thoughts on the future of this industry?
Yeah, I think it's really exciting, and I think, you know, technology is going to play increasingly bigger role. I'm really looking forward to GPT-3 and you know how that technology kind of evolves and finds its kind of real life use cases. I think it's going to just augment and truly kind of augment all of these global customer experiences and workforce experiences with more local content, more relevant content for end users. So I think it's going to be a good, fun, and crazy future ahead of us in localization industry.
Who wants to go next? Arl?
Sure.
Any parting thoughts?
Yeah, good and crazy may be a good way to describe it right now, because we're at a moment of profound change. I think we're actually probably entering a golden age in some way for translators, but there will be some pain getting there, and some people will find ways that they've cherished of doing things are going to be overturned. But the net direction right now, I think, is absolutely fantastic for the industry.
Brian?
I agree. I just would say that the great Dr. Maya Angelou used to say, when you know better, you do better. We all know better. So it's just about doing better and better. It's always going to change. You're never going to have the tiger by the tail. Let it go.
And I would say that we are at an inflection point in the industry, like we have seen in when the internet entered the industry and transformed it completely. We saw it in 2006 with the Vista operating system. That was a big change in the industry. And we're going to see it now in the next couple of years with the introduction of 5G, not the telephone 5G, 5G in the infrastructure. And that is going to have a huge impact in volumes and formats and types of communication, and that will require a lot more engagement for from our industry. So I see the future of the industry as bright, being it's like, think of in the year 2000, we didn't have LinkedIn, we didn't have iPhones, we didn't have Facebook, we didn't have any of the technologies that we use today. How much localization and translation has generated because of those things, right? We're going to go into another phase where it's hard to imagine, but there's going to be an explosion of content technology, new things for us to be playing with and translating. So I'm very optimistic.
I'm gonna take one last. We've had a very active chat, so I know we're at the bottom of the program here. I'm gonna have one last comment, I think, to end on, or question, which is someone putting a comment about the future UX perspectives on visual deployment of language beyond mobile platforms like augmented or virtual reality landscapes, which I think is interesting. Any parting thoughts on that before we end here?
It's here right now. We're literally in day three right now of a 20,000 person event for a major IT, and we're doing it with remote simultaneous interpretation because that was the right choice for that fit of content. Yeah. At the end of the day, content is always king and language is always going to be here.
The comment about virtual reality is quite interesting because if you look at it today, It's a failed technology. We are not adopting it as people expected, as the technologists expected. But it doesn't mean that it's not going to have a comeback. The first attempt that Steve Jobs had to do a personal assistant, the Newton, was a big failure. Nobody wanted it. And all of a sudden, we're all carrying mobile phones in our pockets. And it was a failed technology, a failed idea. People abandoned it at the time. And I think that virtual reality is one of those technologies. If you have tried it, I have right behind me here, I have a Google Glass. It's my memento of a failed investment, something that had promising future, everybody talked about and never materialized, but it's coming back. I see it in my car. I see in other ways that are not necessarily the way that people envisioned it originally, but became dominant in different areas. In a very low-key way, it's coming in, and virtual reality and augmented reality are going to be a reality. And the question, I think, had to do with interpretation. I would totally see the virtual interpreter sitting here among us in the middle here, like a 3D position, doing maybe ASL and some other kind of intermediation for us.
And there are some incredible language technologies out there working in this space that, you know, would take hours to describe. And you haven't seen them yet. They're still a bit in the lab, but
yeah,
it's like something out of a sci-fi movie right now, what's out there.
You know, there's so much to talk about. We're still getting good comments in chat, actually, and even a question about will there be a summer event? So, you know, maybe based on that, we're just scratching the surface on this topic. And, you know, it's something that we continue maybe in another event, you know, I just want to thank everybody today. It's been a great 90 minutes, I think, a really great session. Arl, maybe a question for you coming in. If there are other questions, we'll find a way to get them, you know, channel to the right panelist and see if we can't get responses back after the discussion today. Thanks very much, everybody. It's been a great discussion today. And thanks, everyone, for joining us on Facebook and LinkedIn.